Today's date is January the 21st, 2020. And there's several of us sitting here with Mr. Murdoch Walker. We have J.D. Kugler and Patricia Snook with the Polk County Historical Commission. And Phyllis Harrell is with us. We're actually at Phyllis and George Harrell's home. And I'm Joyce Johnston with the Polk County Historical Commission. And we're sitting with Mr. Murdoch Walker. And he's ready to spin his story for us. Mr. Walker?
Thank you. 97 years and 5 days ago, I came into this old world at about 9:30 at night. I was brought in by a midwife. And we had no running water, no electricity, or no heat except a hot fireplace and a cook stove. After I was born and straightened out and everything got going good, my daddy got two sticks of kindling wood to make the lady that was the midwife a fire or a torch so she could see to get home. She had about a half a mile to walk in the dark without a light. Nobody had a flashlight or a lantern. After that, I grew up and made it to school age and started the school over at Sody School, walking 2 miles to school, 2 miles from school, on a dirty, muddy road that was just graded occasionally when it was dry enough and whatnot, and walked it back and forth numerous times without even seeing an automobile. When we got to the fifth grade, Daddy got us transferred to Camp Ruby, and we rode a bus back and forth to Camp Ruby. So I went to Camp Ruby School in the fifth and sixth grade. Then when we got into the seventh grade, we moved back to Sody because they had consolidated the Indian Reservation in Midway to go to school in Livingston, and I rode the same bus that those kids rode. When I graduated from Livingston in 1941, I started as a freshman over at Sam Houston that fall on an athletic scholarship. That year, the Japs dropped the bombs on Pearl Harbor, and that played havoc with everything that there was going on. After that, I went into the military and stayed in the military for 4 years. Then I came back and went back to Sam Houston, got my degree from Sam Houston, started teaching and coaching at Hull Day Zeta. That was a school that kind of out in the woods by itself, so to speak, and I stayed there 4 years. I was head basketball coach, assistant football coach. After that, I moved to Winnie, East Chambers, as head athletic director, head football coach, and school teacher. I stayed there in that same system 30 years. When at 30 years, I decided it was time to retire, and there were seven of us that were veterans when I went down there. Today, I'm the only one left. And there was three of us that were going to retire on the same year, and at that time, I was teaching woodshop, and the superintendent got the three of us out in that woodshop one evening, and I'll try to quote him verbatim. He said, "Fellas, you can't do me this way. I can't hire one of you to be replaced, much less all three of you. If all three of you leave, I'm going to see, can I get me another job?" Anyway, to make the long story short, one of them stayed two more years, one of them stayed another year, but I had to leave because I had cows that were depending on me, and I retired and moved back to Sody, and I've been living in Sody ever since.
Back up a little bit. That's a great synopsis of your life and really gives us an insight into where you've been and where you are now. But I have, you know, Mr. Kugler's here, and I understand that the two of you went to Livingston School together.
J.D. and I graduated in 1941, and we graduated in the largest class that was graduated from Livingston until integration. There was 110 of us in the graduating class.
Okay, and where did, 110, that's a huge class. Mm-hmm. So those kids came from all around? I mean, all the small communities were bused into Livingston,
yes,
at that time?
At that time, Unalaska came into Livingston.
Oh, okay. Mr. Kugler, do you want
to say why it was a large class? That was when the sixth and seventh year started at the same time. That's when they changed the age limit from seven when you started to six when you started. So that put two age groups together.
Oh, that's okay.
When that was 110.
Okay, when we visit with Mr. Kugler, he could name some of his favorite school teachers. We don't know if he was telling the truth or not, but he was probably a pretty good student, and probably you were too. So do you have some memories of some of your favorite school teachers?
Well, I can truthfully say that I never had a teacher in school that I didn't think was a good one. I was also a teacher, and I thought I was a good one. I'm bad about telling stories anyway, and I'll tell this story. Back years ago, when I was there in Winnie, I was inducted into the Hall of Honor.
Yes.
Okay.
And,
I
have also been inducted to the Hall of Honor at Sam Houston. I lettered in three sports over there. I'm the only individual from Polk County that ever lettered in three college sports.
At Sam Houston?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. And what were the sports?
Football, basketball, and track.
Okay. When you were in Livingston, I'm sure you played all those sports,
I lettered in all three of those sports, yes.
And, who was your coach when you were in Livingston?
A fellow by the name of Paradeaux, Louis Paradeaux, Paradeaux.
Okay.
Was he here the whole time you were in high school?
Yes. I played 1 year of professional football in 1948 at Pittsburgh Steelers. My salary was $3,500. I had signed a 2-year contract. I came back to Sam Houston after the first season was over and started working on my master's degree and got married that summer and got a job teaching down at Holiday Zeta and coaching for $3,600. I got married and my wife got a job, so I didn't go back. 1 year of pro ball is all I played. And I started teaching and coaching then at Day Zeta. Stayed there 4 years, and then got the head football coaching and teaching school down at Winnie, and I stayed there 30 years. I played Livingston in football 4 years. The first year, they beat me, and the next 3 years, I won, and they wouldn't play me anymore. They said I was in class 2A, and they were in 3A, and they said it was bad getting beat by a lower classification.
When you were in high school, who were some of your favorite teachers in Livingston? Who did you...
Mrs. McCardle was one. You remember her.
Ethel McCardle. And she was a history teacher.
And Mr. Seaman was a vocational ag teacher. That was probably my best class.
I was
one of the top dogs in that class, but in the others, I was just there. That was about all. And Mr. Bounds was a math teacher. Mr. Adams was math teacher. And what was our typing teacher? Do you remember?
Horn was her name, wasn't it?
I don't know. I don't remember.
I think it was.
I can't. That's just one of the things that I don't remember.
But you're talking about Paradeaux a while ago. Don't forget Bubba Grenan was your basketball.
Yeah, Bubba Grenan was basketball coach, yes.
Bubba what?
Grenan, G-E-R-N-A-N-D.
Okay, that's a new name on me also.
Yeah. He's from Beaumont.
Oh, okay.
He, after I started teaching and coaching at Winnie, he was an official, a basketball official back in that area. And I had him at numerous occasions as a basketball referee when I was coaching at Winnie.
Well, what were some of the other activities at Livingston High School? Did y'all have proms? And when we interviewed another gentleman that grew up in Livingston, he said that if you were playing sports, the girls really loved you. So I'm sure you had lots of girlfriends growing up and had somebody on your arm if you had a prom to go to.
Well, you're getting into a different department now. when I was in high school in Livingston, we rode the bus back and forth, and there was no activities that we were involved in, except the sporting activities that they would run the school bus back and forth to. My mother and daddy never had a transportation system except a wagon and a pair of mules.
Oh.
We didn't have a motorized vehicle. And if we went anywhere, we either walked, rode a horse, or went in a wagon. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anybody in Sody at that time that could have come up with $200. Everybody was poor folks. Everybody farmed for a living. We farmed 30 acres with mules and horses, and about 20 acres of that would be cotton, and about 10 of it be corn, peas, and sorghum to have food for the animals. Everybody in the country then had a milk cow, had laying hens, and had hogs to have food and whatnot during the winter, and something to eat and whatnot to live on.
Did the school bus come down 190? I know it was a dirt road at that time. Did it just stop at the end of 190, or did it come down your road?
The bus that I rode started at Midway and the Indian Reservation and went to Livingston to the school, and then when school would be out, we rode the same bus back.
Where did you get off the bus going home? Where did it come in front of your house, or did you have to walk a long way?
Well, we had to walk about 300 yards from the highway. Now, when we were going to school at Sody, and like I said a while ago, we walked two miles to the school and 2 miles home.
When you decided to go into the service, did you go into the service after Pearl Harbor?
I didn't decide. They decided.
Okay, that's what I thought. So you got your notice, but it was after Pearl Harbor was bombed. Okay, did you get to decide which branch to go or what to do? Or?
Well, when you're drafted, you don't have a choice. They put you where they want you and whatnot.
Okay.
And I was put in combat engineers, and we mostly did work. We didn't do much fighting, and we did all kinds of road work and construction work. And on the island of Guam, we built a big runway that the B-29s took off from that dropped the atomic bombs that ended the war.
So how long were you in the service?
I'm drawing 4 years of teacher retirement on my military time.
So you were there 4 years?
4 years.
So when you were drafted, did you go to the draft board there in Livingston, and did you leave from Livingston?
I left from Huntsville.
Oh, Huntsville. Okay.
On the night before, I went into this is a little bit more bragging, I guess. On the night before I went into the Army, which was in February, I played a basketball game at the University of Texas. I didn't want to go. The coach always called me Walk. He never said Murdoch or Walker. He said, "No, Walk, we got to have you. I'll buy you a bus ticket. You can come back home and get back in time to catch the bus to go to Huntsville tomorrow. Go to Austin tomorrow." No, San Antonio, that's where I went into the military. Anyway, that's the way I did. I rode the bus all the way back to Huntsville the night after the ball game and went into the Army the next day.
Okay, where did they... Okay, you went to San Antonio first.
Yeah.
And you were there until you were sent to Guam?
No, I went from San Antonio to Shepherd Field, Texas for basic training. In the basic training department, we made a 36-mile hike that took 14 hours. About two-thirds of the group didn't make it, and about one-third of them did. And I was one of the one-third that made it. I'd have been the last one that would have quit.
So they knew they had a strong person, you know, to help build those roads, I guess.
Well, the outfit that I was in was a kind of a special outfit. It was about one-third Texans, about one-third from Oklahoma, and the rest was from everywhere. The outfit that I was in, we won the island championship in softball on Guam, and the entire infield was Texas boys. I was the number one batter out of the bunch, and there was a fellow that had played a little bit of semi-pro ball from Oklahoma. He would tell me, said, "Tex, you got to be a liar. That nobody could hit a softball like you do that never played baseball." But I never played a baseball game in my life. When I was in high school, Livingston didn't have baseball. When I went to Huntsville in 1941 as an athlete, they didn't play baseball, but they did start after the war. But I never tried to make the team, which I probably could have made and been four-sport letterman. But it was during track, and I didn't try to participate in it.
So did you spend your entire military overseas in Guam?
No, I was in Florida for a year.
Yeah, but overseas. The whole time you were overseas during the war, was it Guam?
No, I went from Guam to Okinawa. I was on Okinawa when the war ended. After the war was over, I was getting ready to come home, and we had some Japanese prisoners, about 25, in a stockade that we had there. And I don't know any of the details of how it worked or why it worked, but they let those prisoners out of the stockade there and let them work there in the area where the camp was. They would mow grass and straighten up and trim hedges and things of that nature. I was getting ready to come home, and there was one of those prisoners that decided that there was fixing to be a change. I was throwing away old letters and packages and whatnot that I had received, and he got right up in front of me and put his hand on my chest, turned and pointed east. He says, "America," shook his head. I yelled, "Bye-bye, going home." He turned around and pointed west to Japan, said, "Japan?" No, no, he didn't want to go to Japan. He had it better there as a PW than he would have had it if he had gone home in Japan. I got on back to the States then, came in to Seattle, Washington, and the people that were working in the mess hall there in Seattle were German PWs, and they could all speak English. And every one of them that I had any association with whatsoever wanted to know if there was any way that I could help them stay over here. They'd rather be over here as a prisoner than over in Germany as a citizen.
So tell us, when you came home, what kind of reception did you get when you got home? Had you not seen your family in the 4 years that you were gone?
No, I hadn't seen my family in 27 months. I was only overseas 27 months. During the time that I was in Florida, we were working on some experimental operations. We built a runway out of paneling, metal paneling, that looked like it would be good. It was each joint was bratted together with the other joints and whatnot, and it was put on ground, just earth. It wasn't built up or anything, but it got soft, and it got to where it would just look like waves when an airplane would land on it, and they canceled that. We didn't go into the war with that. And they also tried carrying small operating machines in, what do you call those things you pull behind an airplane? Glider. They put these little machines on a glider and would go in places and show operation duties and whatnot. But they decided that it was too little and wasn't worth having, so they canceled that. And then after about a year and 2 months in Florida, and we built bombing targets in the Everglades for the B-24s, that's what they had back in those days, to practice dropping bombs on and whatnot. They stopped that then. They got ready to ship us overseas, and we never saw any more B-24s. We got to the B-29s after that.
What branch of the service was it, Army or Navy?
I was in the Army, Combat Engineers, made sergeant. When the war was over, they wanted some individuals for the occupation forces in Japan, and they offered anyone that had a sergeant's rating of any kind there on Okinawa a direct second lieutenant's commission to go for one more year and go to Japan. And there wasn't anybody in my outfit that volunteered. Everybody came home.
So how did you, when you came back to the States after the service, when you came back to the States, how long did it take for you to get back to the States before you got back to SOTA? How did you transfer back? How did you get, did you have to ride a bus? Did you come on an airplane? How did you get back to Texas?
From Seattle, we came to San Antonio on a troop train. That's how we got back, and I was discharged the day after my 23rd birthday.
And then how'd you get back to Texas?
I was already in Texas, I rode the bus from San Antonio to Livingston. That's where I was back home when I got to Livingston.
Was anybody else from Polk County on Guam with you? Did you have any Anybody that you knew over there?
On the island of Guam, the only visitation that I had at all from somebody that I knew was Orval Harrell. He was on Saipan. Saipan was about 40 miles from Guam, and on a sunny day you could see it. And he was in the Air Force, and he and I wrote back and forth together and whatnot, and we knew where each other was. And on two occasions, they had to come over to Guam to get their mail. And on two occasions, he came over with the mail plane and spent the night with me, and then caught it the next day and went back. And then when I got on Okinawa, I had an uncle that was there, had a brother that was there, had a fellow that was married to a first cousin that was there. Aunt Harold's cousin was there. So we nearly had an old kinfolks reunion on Okinawa.
When you were in Guam, what kind of housing did you guys have?
Nothing but tents. When I first landed on Guam, the first duty that I had was checking landmines. The whole squad that I was in, we took landmines and went all over that island looking for the mines that the Japanese had buried. After we got that done, the second week that I was there, they didn't have a harbor on Guam, and they had to anchor the big ships about 3 miles offshore. And I spent the next 6 weeks unloading ships to get the materials and supplies that we needed into Guam. We worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and when we got our 12 hours done, there was no bed, no mattress, no flooring of any kind to have a mattress, I have a bed on. So you got your sleeping, your duffel bag, went into a corner somewhere where you'd be out of the way. You miss a night or two of getting a little rest, but you get where you do pretty good.
What did you have food?
We ate K rations. They came in sealed containers.
Okay.
And everybody got a K ration at mealtime. There was no cooking or anything of that nature. But the K rations were pretty good. They were all right. Not a thing wrong with the K rations. While we were on the island of Guam, we were having problems getting fresh water. If you went down 10 or 12 feet, you got salt water. And you had to catch water by rain, or find a gully or something, or a pond to get you water. And we built a hospital on Guam and needed water for it. And there was a place up at the north end of the island which was rough in terrain and whatnot. It was hilly and rocky and whatnot. And there was a place up there that there was actually water running through the area that you could see from the top of the ground, was about 6 or 8 feet down, and they called it the Running River that was there, the natives did. And those natives that were on Guam were all dark-complected, looked like they were Spanish, Mexicans, or that nature, and the only language on the island was English. So everybody spoke English that was native on the island. But somebody decided that the thing to do was go to this little underground river, they called it, and tap it in with pipe so they could put water in the hospital that we had built. The hospital was already there. And there was my company was designated to do it. So we got two boats, or were tugboats of a sort, from the Seabees. Different outfits would help other outfits. In other words, a Navy, we worked with the Seabees some, we worked with the Marines some and whatnot, and they were then Seabees. And we carried two loads of pipe to Guam, to the area where we were going to build this runway to the hospital, and unloaded it, and we had to carry it by hand to where the location was, because it was hilly and unlevel and whatnot. And there would be four individuals for each joint of pipe. There was 4-inch metal pipe. And we unloaded one load and needed another load there, but there was a different platoon going to work on it. And the load that I had helped unload was going back to get another load of pipe. And the captain of the boat asked, well, so I go with me, so I won't have to go by myself and whatnot. And one of the fellows said, I'll go. So he went, and they left, and that next day they didn't come back, and they got to worrying and wondering about them and whatnot. and found out that the Japs had that had bombed that tugboat that was going back after the pipe. And the one that was in our outfit, he drifted ashore there on the island, and we found him, but the other one has never been found. But to get on my story there, the first night we spent there, everybody had a pup tent, and two slept in a pup tent. You put two together, and one slept beside the other, and we camped on the sandbar about where we were unloading the materials. And then the night, somebody began shooting. I never heard so much shooting. Bang, 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 bang. And me and my buddy had gotten over to one side a little bit by a big rock. And there couldn't anybody get to where our tent was except by knowing where to go and whatnot. And we figured out, we whispered and whatnot, well, stay quiet, stay quiet. Anyway, there must have been 25 or 30 shots went off. And the next morning when it began to get daylight, I thought, well, we may be the only ones left, but they began to call names and whatnot, having answering and whatnot. Anyway, when it got daylight, we got to check in and find out what had happened. And that night while we were sleeping and whatnot, there were some Japs that were still on the island that hadn't given up or weren't captive yet, that was moving north. And they came right into our tent area there, and our guard got to shooting at them. And actually, somebody killed one. There was one dead Jap there, but we didn't have a soldier that got hit. So I guess the Japs didn't shoot. They didn't carry rifles much. They carried hand grenades mostly. And we got everybody organized in, and the next night that we camped there, everybody did a little better job of camping. And the one that was killed actually had on a pair of American athletic socks. And everybody has wondered how in this world he come with that pair of athletic socks, but he had them.
Were you able to receive packages from home? Did your folks send you packages?
After you got settled on an area, you could. We stayed anchored 42 days and nights at a little island by the name of Aniwetok, waiting for the invasion of Guam. And during that time, we didn't get any mail.
But you were able to, when you did have mail, and you could send mail back home.
Oh,
I was thinking of the mothers waiting back home to hear from their sons and how devastating that must be.
Well, my mother had two sons that was in the service, and I've heard her tell the story that she usually would go and meet the postman hoping to get a letter.
Let's go back to when you were in college and you got your notice to go to overseas. Back then, everybody was so patriotic, and nobody tried to fight it. Nobody tried to figure out a way to not go. They went. So how did you feel? What was patriotism like when you were getting ready to?
Well, I didn't like it. Of course I didn't like it, but I don't guess anybody did. But if you were drafted, you had no choice, and that's the way, mainly the way that they got people into the military then. Like I said a while ago, I played that basketball game on the night before, and then I got back home and back to Huntsville, and went into to the military the next day, and then stayed in it till I got to go home two different times before I went overseas. And then when you're overseas, you don't get to come home for anything. If family members died or anything, you were just noticed. You didn't go home.
Right. So how did you get most of your news about what was going on building toward the war when you were in high school and college?
Well, you didn't get any in high school about, as a matter of fact, the only war that was going on when I was in high school was over in Germany, and I was in high school, I played sports and whatnot, thought nothing about it, actually wasn't even interested in knowing about it.
So y'all just had radio contact, right?
Oh yeah, that's all we had, no television or anything.
The world was a lot larger then than it is now, it seems. So
the only correspondence you had then was either telephone or sending those messages through the
Western Union.
What?
Western Union?
Well, yeah, Western Union.
And those always brought bad news, I've been told. You didn't want a message from Western Union, a telegraph, okay?
Listen, I mean, this is kind of retracting, but let's go back when you were a little boy. And tell us some of the fun things you did as a little boy, not school-wise, but play and things, activities that you did besides working. I know you worked hard, but
well, back when I was growing up, everybody had chores, when you got home from school and whatnot, if it was winter time, my job was to get fireplace wood and get in wood for the cook stove, and get in kindling for the fireplace, kindling for the cook stove, feed the animals and gather the eggs and all those good things that country people did back in those days. And getting back to still further, when I got over to Sam Houston before the war, you could go to a movie for a dime, buy a sack of popcorn or a bag of peanuts or a cold drink for a nickel. And it was a half a mile from up at the college where the dormitories and whatnot were, down to Huntsville where the theater was. And I never got turned down on a date because one didn't want to walk that half a mile. But I don't imagine a fella could get a date now and walk her down to the old theater and back.
I bet not. Oh, goodness. Well, tell us, what were some of your favorite movies from that time?
I guess my favorite movie of all time would have been Gone with the Wind.
Do you keep up with any of the people that you were in the service with? I know Mr. Kugler does, some of the people that were in his...
The answer to that is no. When we were first discharged, there was several of us that wrote letters back and forth for a period of maybe 3 years. But it eventually played out, and the last one that I made contact with was about 4 or 5 years ago. I got a call one morning over on Soda Loop East where I live, and it was one of the fellows that I was in the 1885th with. And we wrote a couple more letters back and forth, but it played out again.
So you don't know, okay, if he's still
with... Not any of them that I'm corresponding with now. And there are not many of them left. When I went to Winnie in 1953, I think I made that statement a while ago. There were 7 of us that were there that were veterans. I'm the only one left. When I started school over at Sody in 1929, there was 14 of us in the first grade. In those days, the Walkers and the Harrells were the dominant race and dominant name here in Sody. There were 4 of us that were cousins in that 14 in the first grade. And I'm the only one left out of that 14 now.
I would like for you to tell us again, when we visited before I turned the recorder on, you were telling us about your name. Tell that story about your name that your family gave you and how you ended up with being called Murdoch.
Well, when it got time to come up with a name, my daddy had been in World War I, and he had a very special friend whose last name was Avery. And he insisted on having Avery, and Mother does not or did not know. I have asked her on 2 or 3 occasions how she came up with Murdoch, but she didn't know. It just came to her, and she wanted that to be my name. So the name Avery Murdoch, but instead of calling me Avery, which would have been more simple, they called me Murdoch. And I was Murdoch during the time that I was in college and then high school and whatnot. When I was at Pittsburgh, I was Avery. And then when I was in the Army, I was Tex. I was Tex Walker. And I was a little better than the average individual in the military. I had the best batting average on the softball team. We went to the finals in basketball on the island of Guam, got beat 1 point by a colored outfit in the basketball final game. And I went by the Tex. I was Tex Walker when I was in the Army. And on 4 out of 5 occasions, I would be high point man when we would have a basketball game. The good Lord bless this old man in the sporting world.
And I love sports, and I don't play them, you know, like you do, like you did. But I think it's a really wonderful thing for our society.
Had it not been for sports, I could not have got a college education. That was what got my education. Uh-huh. In those days, you went and tried out, and if you were good enough, you got a contract. If you didn't get good, if you weren't good enough, you got sent back home.
Mm. How did you get to the Pittsburgh Steelers? Did they come to Sam Houston, or how did you?
I rode a train to Pittsburgh.
What made you even want to go? I mean, how did they find out about you?
Well, when you play in college football and you make all conference, and I made all conference 2 years, and was inducted into the Hall of Honor over there, and that kind of gives you a little opening. And I was contacted by a representative, was given this contract and whatnot, and it was my duty to get to Pittsburgh. They were not responsible for me getting there. And I rode a train to Pittsburgh.
And so you had a tryout then when you got to Pittsburgh?
Well, when I got to Pittsburgh, they already knew that I knew what was going on, so there was no tryout. They usually got your uniform and went to the field.
Oh, okay. So
that was kind of an experience for a young boy from Soda to go to Sam Houston and then go all the way up Pittsburgh.
Well, there was a good many things that were pretty much experiences for this old man back during the days. I'm going to do a little bit bragging now. Back when I was in Winnie, about the fourth year maybe that I was there, I had a study hall session in the library. And on one occasion one morning, the librarian, which was an older lady, came up. She never called me Murdoch or Walker. She said, always referred to me as Mister. She said, Mister, will you be Paul Bear at my funeral? And everybody referred to her as Miss Millie. I said, Miss Millie, I don't know your family or anything about anybody except just you. I know you've got some sons and your husband's dead, but that's all about all. She says, that doesn't matter. Says, when I die, the only thing my family's got to do is come to my funeral. And I like the way you do things, and I like the way you operate. And I would appreciate you being a pallbearer at my funeral. I said, put me down. So one morning after I moved over where I'm living, over there right now, I got a call. It's been about 15 years ago now. This man called me and said, Mr. Walker, I've got my wife's list here of pallbearers, and you're on it at such and such time. Can you be here? I said, mark me down. I'll be there. So I influenced people, I guess, a little bit along the line, and she wanted me as a pallbearer, even though I was not related, and she had not known me before I moved to Winnie. On the day that I decided to retire and sent my resignation into to the main office, there was several of the teachers that tried to talk me into staying, but there's a little bit more to my story than I told a while ago. The house where I'm living there now, at one time was a wooden house. When I bought that place, it was wood. And when that big sawmill operated over there where Wayne Woods is living, there was an old doctor that built that house and lived there. And at one time, it was the nicest house in Sody. And the people that were living there didn't pay any rent. They just fed and took care of my cows. And they were having house cleaning in March and messed around and let the fire get out and burn my house down. So I didn't have any choices to retire or sell my cows. So I decided I was doing about as well in the cattle business as I was by working anyway. So I retired and moved in there and built my house where I'm living now and took care of my cows. And kept my cows until I turned 80 and sold my cows and got out of the cow business and been doing a little gardening and living and let living ever since.
Well, where did you meet your wife?
I can't answer that really. She was a member of a family that was real good friends of mine, and her husband had died. There's a little bit more of this story that I guess most of you know about. I've been married twice. I was first divorced. Then I wasn't gonna get married anymore, and I stayed single 7 years, and then she showed up and whatnot after her husband had died, and I had been where she was and whatnot a few times, and I decided that she was just too good to let get away. And we got married then, and we stayed married 43 years.
Congratulations.
And they were wonderful years. We had 3 deep freezes. We kept vegetables in one, we kept venison in one, we kept beef in one. I fattened out and butchered beef and killed venison and grew vegetables, and she was an exceptional cook. So for those 43 years, I did some good eating.
Killed some hogs, too.
Boy, yeah, we raised hogs, too, yeah.
Yeah.
And I raised corn, fattened on yearlings and so forth. So I was pretty independent.
Seems like you're still pretty independent.
Well, I am. I don't ask for much.
Well, Mr. Walker, this has been really wonderful. We appreciate your time. Is there anything else that pops into your memory right now that you'd like to share with us?